Ani Jigabikwe Natisnakaz. My name is Where the Land and Water Meet Woman, but I'm also known as Diane. So you have to kind of bear with me. I actually forgot my entire speech at home, so I know my story. I lived it, so it's we'll see how it goes. So currently, I am the housing director over at Regina Youth for Christ. What that means is I oversee 4 group homes with youth who are in the care of the Ministry of Social Services. So my background, I have a Bachelor of Social Work degree, but that's a piece of paper. I think my journey and my personal story is what and how I can do the work that I do with youth. So I'm just... There are different parts of my journey. There are different chapters, and so I'm going to kind of start from the beginning. My mother was about 15 years old when she gave birth to me. And so I consider myself being born into a grieving nation, born to a mom who didn't know how to love or to parent me. I didn't know then, I didn't know at that time, the reason why she was the way she was. And as a result, I was unable to live with her. I spent the first probably about 4 years living with my cookum, my grandma, just probably outside of Salt Coats, like down by the Yorkton area. Then one day, a black sedan vehicle pulled up at my grandma's house, and my sisters, I was probably about 4, and they were 3 and 2, or 2 and 1, like we were babies. And I remember them asking us to get into the vehicle. I was trying to pack my sister's diapers or bottles. I didn't speak English. English is actually my second language. Nakwe is my native tongue, also known as the Soto language here in Saskatchewan. And so getting into the vehicle and then looking back and not realizing that would be the last time I actually would see my grandma. I didn't know what was happening. Through conversations with my sisters and I, we realized that we were in probably maybe 2 or 3 foster homes before we ended up in one foster home in Yorkton. And that's the one that we ended up for probably more like 3 or 4 years. The foster homes were non-Indigenous. They were quite abusive. So we're just kind of, our memories between the three of us are able to kind of put together what our experiences was. I didn't know that I was Indigenous. I didn't know of the racism that I was experiencing until later in life. I do remember one of the bus rides into Yorkton going to school was my sisters and I, we had braids. And I remember the youth, they cut my braids. They would be taunting, they'd be teasing, and they would do that kind of Hollywood war cry. It didn't impact me as great as my youngest sister, who to this day is if she can pass as white, that's what she's going to do. She doesn't really acknowledge her Indigenous ancestry because of her journey and her story. We were in Yorkton. The school doesn't exist anymore, but there was a lot of a negative experience being an Indigenous youth child. But the disheartening part of it was that I lost my native tongue. Because of going into the public schools, because of the foster homes, I needed to speak English. Like, nobody was able to relate. During that time, while I was in foster care, I only met my mom once. We only had one home visit. Actually, it wasn't even a home visit. She was incarcerated at that time. And so I learned that my foster mom had taken my sisters and I up to PA to have a family visit. So I only have one picture of myself and my mom as a child. I don't have any baby pictures. I don't have anything beyond So we would have gotten to that home when I was 4. So that's the youngest that I have. They took a picture of us when we first entered that home, and then one picture with my mom, and I don't have any other pictures of family. Then one day they drove us to Saskatoon. It was dark, and put my sisters and I on a plane, and we ended up in Nova Scotia, where we were adopted to a non-Indigenous family. They were a wealthy family. The community was wealthy, very white. My sisters and I were the only brown faces in that entire school. They were very abusive, emotionally, sexually, physically, and culturally abusive. One of the things that has stuck out the most and has had the greatest impact in my journey of identifying as an Indigenous person was my adopted mom would continually tell me that I love you, but I don't see the color of your skin. And so recognizing my skin is not white, and so every time I looked in the mirror and to hear that she didn't see the color of my skin. So as a young child, trying to figure out what's wrong with the color of my skin. So that caused a lot of self-esteem issues, self-worth issues, just a whole whack of things. And then on top of that, my adoptive father was extremely violent, physically and sexually abusive. By the time I was 13, I ended up running away. It was like January 1st, I think 1987. I finished babysitting. I stole a pack of cigarettes. I didn't smoke. I just thought that was kind of cool, stealing a pack of cigarettes, because I was kind of trying to be bad. But then I also stole beer, and I sat in front of the police station, and I drank the beer. I needed a way out, and I didn't know how to get out. I had previously contacted the police. I knew something was wrong, and I needed somebody to help me. But because of the status of my adoptive parents, nobody believed me. I had told family friends who were supposed to be safe people to go to when something was wrong. Nobody believed me. I befriended a police officer. But again, because of the status of my adoptive parents, nobody listened to me. And so that night I sat and I drank beer for the first time. And then the police started chasing me, and then just running the streets of, so it was Chester, Nova Scotia, if people are knowing that community. Specifically in the summertime, the wealthy people from the States all come up it's a huge sailing community. So finally got picked up by the police. They took me to their clinic. They put me in a room that had a wall full of pharmaceuticals. And because I was intoxicated, I was hurt, I took whatever, all the color, because it was very colorful. And so I took a bunch of pills and then ended up in the IWK in Halifax. When I finally came to, I was adamant that I did not want to be returned back to that home. I was finally able to use my voice and said, I'm not going back. If I'm going back, then I'm going to leave and I'm going to run again. And so my adoptive parents ended up putting me into the mental institution in Dartmouth, Nova Scotia. And this was the old kind of style mental institutions where, I mean, they had an adolescent unit, but they still had kind of like the dungeons. They still had it's not a good place to be as a young teenager. And so I was there probably in its entirety for about 6 to 8 months. But during that time, my adoptive parents did not want anybody to know what was happening in their home, and so they needed to silence me. And so I was put on medication. Medication to the point where I was almost comatose. I was going blind. I wasn't a human. And so one of my roommates was telling me, you need to take your meds. And so, of course, I started to do that, started to get back to my regular self. And then we ended up running. And so I spent several weeks out on the streets. And then that several weeks ended up being several months. And so as a result of living on the streets, I got involved in prostitution, into drugs, into alcohol, and the more I prostituted myself, the more I was feeling ashamed of my situation, the more then I drank and the more I used. Just learning that lifestyle and learning to figure out like what was happening to me. Then during that time out on the streets, I ended up in a party. And so I was probably about at the 14, 15 now. I was at a party. I was under the influence of drugs. And then I was gang raped by four people. So then when I went to the police station, they took me to the hospital. The gang rape, I don't remember too much about it. I remember like my body feeling afterwards, but I don't remember. The worst part for me was going into that hospital and hearing the nurse blame me, say, "Oh, just another Indian. It's your fault. You put yourself in that situation." So again, experiencing this racism against an Indigenous people, and I still wasn't understanding what that meant. Like, I knew I was different, but I didn't understand. And so going through that experience, humiliation and shame pushed me back onto the streets, pushed me back into drinking, drinking heavily to the point where I would black out because I didn't want to feel. I didn't want to feel what was like life. And also what coming to terms with being sexually abused, being physically abused by people who were supposed to be my parents, people who were supposed to take care of me, because they claimed they were rescuing me from a life that was less than what they were providing me. So I'm not sure which was the better of the two evils. Then as I was getting probably into about 16, 17, I ended up getting arrested, which was probably the best thing for me because the judge actually took the time and listened. They're like, "Well, you used to be a track star. You used to be an honor student. What happened?" And so trying to explain, hesitant at first, but he's like, "No, I want to know." Like, stopped everything, and he's like, "Just tell me what was happening." And so finally, disclosing the abuse, and so then my adoptive father was arrested and charged. He was convicted, but back then, the conviction was, "Don't talk to your victim," and then on his way, right? But it was a start, and to me, it was just that acknowledgement and that affirmation that my pain and suffering was heard and somebody was going to do something about it. And so after that, I was placed in different group homes, open custody because I kept getting in trouble with the law. I remember the times I did go to high school. I did well. But again, you connect with people who are more like you, right? And so there was a group, we called ourselves the Pit Crew, and so we were like stoners, we would always be high, and just getting into trouble. But through all of that, there was something I couldn't figure out. I understood, I think in my heart, that I was experiencing this stuff for a reason, but I just couldn't figure out why. I couldn't figure out why I was being put through this and surviving. It was a very dark period in my life. I never hated anybody as much as I hated myself. I was clinically depressed, chronically depressed, and I needed an out. I didn't want to die, per se. I wanted the pain to stop, but I would do every effort to try to kill myself, especially drinking alcohol to the point where I've had my stomach pumped. I can't even count. It's so many times. I have scars on my body from falling out of windows, falling out of vehicles, just anything to stop the pain, and so many attempts to take my own life. And so it's just this cycle of pain, of suffering, of mad at the world and angry because nobody was protecting me. Like, nobody was standing up for me. And even in the group homes, which I didn't believe in God. There were past traumas of being in a church and being sexually abused by family members. And so I I hated God. Like, why would God allow me to go through this? Why wouldn't God protect me? And so one of the group homes I ended up in was run by nuns. And so everything that I was doing was wrong. And they were very strict. They just affirmed my belief that God doesn't love me, and that I'm not worthy. And so it was a very, again, it's that life where I couldn't get out of, and tried to get out. And so I ended up connecting with the Canada World Youth Exchange Program in my early 20s, and going there to Thailand. So it was, living in Halifax, and so at the time it was with Ontario and Thailand, the exchange program. And so I go to Ontario, lived with this family who, you know, worked on the farm. But my biggest experience was being in Thailand, because I thought my life was horrendous. But to see the young women who are sold by their parents for their opiates, and then to be put into the sex trade, realized my life was actually pretty good, right? I was saying, to this table was that the village I was in, there was only one house that had running water and electricity. So my job in that village was to walk an hour to the community well and walk an hour back in the morning and in the afternoon. That's 4 hours just to get water for the day. But the biggest impact was working with an organization that was rescuing girls who were in the sex trade. And to see the devastation of these young girls, as young as 10 and 11 having babies. And then they're discarded because they're no good, right? And so then I ended up leaving Thailand because my host family at the time had traditionally adopted me, and so I was at the age where they were marrying off, marrying age. And so I did not want to get married, so I ended up coming back to Canada. But I came back to Canada with no home, no place, no family. And so I get off the plane, and I'm phoning some of my old friends, and I'm like, hey, I'm at the airport, can you come get me? And so, of course, for that period of time, that transition back into Canada, what do I fall into? Back into that lifestyle, because that's all I knew. But I wanted to get out. But I couldn't. I tried, and I get caught up in there. And to the point where I remember at age of 21, I could drink 18 cans of beer, and I could still be functioning. And so once I realized, and I'm counting this, and I'm still pretty much coherent, I'm like, there's something wrong. Like, this is not okay. And so then I joined, so I got hired on at this, it's called Stepping Stones Program. And so it worked with men and women who lived and worked on the streets. And because of my experience, I was able to share with those that were trying to get off the streets or trying to get out of that lifestyle. And so I was able to connect with a lot of the young girls there. And realizing that I wanted to help, but I didn't know how, because I couldn't even help myself. And so around that same time, my sister had already come back to Saskatchewan. She was dating a guy who ended up, his uncle was married to our biological aunt. And so that was how we were able to reconnect with our family of origin. So I came out to Saskatchewan. And I met with my birth mom and my grandma and some aunties, and it was a horrible reunion. I didn't know what to expect, but I figured I didn't feel like I belonged in the community where I was coming from, so I figured coming back home to people like me, that I would gain that sense of belonging. But because they were broken and they were hurting and they were in pain, they didn't receive me well. It triggered pain for my mom, and so her and I did not get along. And it's unfortunate because I had hated her for so long, and couldn't connect to the point where she passed away in 2015. And I wasn't able to resolve some of the issues that I had or let her know that I finally understood why she was the way she was and why she couldn't parent me. Because for the longest time, I thought she hated me. But it wasn't until her passing when realizing that she only loved me the way she knew how. And because of her upbringing, she just couldn't love me the way I needed to be loved. But coming back and starting to see that I belonged to a group of that I was Indigenous, still didn't understand what that meant, didn't fully embrace it because of the society, the racism that was still haunting Indigenous people. So why would I want to try to connect with a group of people that the majority of society disliked or felt like that they hated? But that started my journey of trying to figure out who I am, where's my place in this world, and where do I go? Like, this can't just be my life, this cycle of pain and drinking, because I was still drinking at the time. And so I had met somebody, we were together for about 6 years, but that really started the healing journey for me. And so I started attending different therapies, because I hurt so much. Every part of me hurt, and I needed that to stop, because I couldn't see a future for myself. It was either continuing drinking and dying, so I started different therapies. But in that same time, was starting to really look at myself in the mirror and hearing and understanding when my adoptive mom was saying, "I don't see the color of your skin," and really addressing what does that mean and how is that impacting me, and just seeking out those answers. And so I ended up moving to Ontario, that's when I started doing child welfare. Like in that in between period was I got my degree. But going to Ontario and working for the Children's Aid Society in Barrie, there are there's three major reserves, and so I was able to really connect with people who are very welcoming and opening, and I was willing to learn whatever. Just teach me why my skin is brown. And so I started to learn the Anishinaabewan language, started to identify what it meant to be an Indigenous woman, and really being proud of, you know, I'm an Indigenous person, and I'm a woman, and this is my role. And to be able to know that I survived this horrendous past for a reason. Still not quite sure why I would go through all of that. And so then during all of that, seeking and learning and just solidifying my cultural identity, I ended up getting pregnant. I was a single mom right pretty much from the beginning when I told the father I was pregnant. So when my daughter was about 3 years old, again, we were immersed in the Indigenous culture. God was far from our circle of friends, from my mind or whatever. So when my daughter approached me and asked me about God, no idea where that came from, but I was in a place in my life where this was her journey, and I can't influence her from what I went through. And so wanting to support her, and so seeking out a church that she can learn about God and find those answers. But of course, you take your children to the children's ministry, you drop them off, and then you end up going to the main service, right? And so I didn't think about that quite, you know. And so I ended up going to the service, got caught up. That's how they trick you, right? Like it ended up being where the first sermon I heard was of Andy Stanley. And so Andy Stanley's approach and how I was able to connect what his words to my life. And it was just at that moment of realizing God had a plan for me. He already knew what was happening, and he had already laid it out. And so we were attending that church for quite some time, and then I started challenging the leadership, because I was still really, is there God? Like, how can you physically see him? And, you know, and then the response I got back from asking some of those questions was very hurtful. And so there was a lot, the last conversation I had, I left crying and felt defeated. And so then, of course, what do? You run. And so then I took my daughter out of church, we ended up, about a year later, we ended up back here in Saskatchewan, and we moved across from King's Corner Church of God. And so I phone up King's Corner, "Hey, how's your children's ministry?" Because my daughter, again, was asking, "Why aren't we a church? I want to go back to church. And so ended up being the pastor, who's currently the pastor there. I ended up working with him a while ago in the school system. So I'm like, hey, Brett's kind of cool. Like, he's not this crazy kind of fanatic kind of thing. And so it must be okay. And so soon after we started going to King's Corner Church, I ended up experiencing severe health issues. I was terrified. I was in a place where still not knowing and having a community. But I had this church family who started loving upon my daughter and I, who were praying for us. And so when I was in the hospital, like, they came to visit, and all they wanted to know is, like, how can we help you? How can we serve you? What can we do so that we can make this the recovery? And so through their love, seeing God, and it's like, okay, I can breathe. I allowed myself to break down those walls that I had pretty secure around me, but allowing them to love me and my daughter. But I was still stubborn, and so it took about a year after that when I came to faith. And so it was October 19th, 2014, when sitting in the church, Elijah Tyndale, who's a comedian from the U.S., was doing his spiel at our church at this dessert comedy night. And towards the end of his spiel is when I felt God talking to me. And it's like, okay, I've already been stirring in your heart. You're stubborn. You just need to now publicly declare. And so I did. And it was at that moment, or soon after, my daughter, you can see her shoulders relax, because she's like, now I can actually really talk to you about God. Mm-hmm. Because when she was 3 years old, she had said that the angels came and told her, it is now time to talk to your mom. And so she had already, like, God has already brought her to me to be able to bring to Christ. Because medically, after I had my surgeries, medically, I should not have conceived nor given birth. And so again, it's just the miracle of Christ, of she needed to be born. And so she's quite proud of being my miracle baby through that. And so with her as part of my testimony, because if it wasn't for her, I don't think I would be a Christ follower. And so that journey of coming to faith, knowing that when I look back, God was with me through all of that. Like, even when I didn't want to wake up, even though I wanted to die, God knew that there was something, like, my plan, his plan for me. And so each of these moments. And so that horrendous experience, that pain and suffering, but the resilience to overcome all of that, to be able to now do what I do, which is work with kids who were like me. So kids who are brought up in the system, kids who have experienced trauma, and being able to relate to them and help them on their healing journey. But more so within probably the last 2 years, where I've been challenged as a Christ follower and as an Indigenous person. Because my job wasn't yet done. My identity wasn't yet fulfilled. Because when I started over at Youth for Christ, I was challenged. So some people believe that in order to be Christian, you have to be this way. In order to be Indigenous, you have to be this way. And so I came to a crossroads, and God was loud and clear in my heart, is that I'm actually in Christ, I'm as an Indigenous person, right? But that's been the challenge, and that's been that hard, painful journey that I've recently experienced of what it is to be a Christian and what it is to be Indigenous. Because in our society, there's so much racism against Indigenous people that our culture, our traditions, our faith practices are are demonic. They're summoning evil spirits. And so that was the challenge of being faced and confronted with. But the Christ that I know and the words in the Bible that I'm reading doesn't say that about, it doesn't say Indigenous people, right, are demonic. Picking up my hand drum, I'm not summoning spirits. It's a lack of understanding, and so that's being led by fear. And so when you go into different cultures, things that they may do, well, even here in different churches, people will do things differently. Doesn't necessarily make it wrong. You may not be comfortable in that way to worship. but we still need to respect and honor one another. And so that's been my challenge of trying to figure out as an Indigenous person, who am I trying to please and who am I in Christ? And so I don't need to please other people. I need to please Him and honor Him. And so that's been that challenge. And so my daughter has witnessed that suffering and that pain, because she's never felt that there was a divide. She has always believed that she is a daughter of the Creator. And she's an Indigenous. And she's proud of that. But she's witnessed me experiencing that. And so that kind of really started that journey and challenge for Youth for Christ. And for the conference in this past November, of challenging people that, with the community, of reconciliation. Because Saskatchewan is the heart of Canada. We're pretty much the center. But yet there's so much racism and so much hate that it divides us, divides God's children. And so even some reserves, that it's literally divided. You're either Christian and you don't practice your culture, or you're Christian. Yeah, sorry, you're Christian and you don't practice your culture, or you're traditional and you're not Christian. And so for so many generations, that's the belief, because this is where now I understand where my mom and my family came from. Because my grandmother, my great-grandmother were all survivors of the residential school. And so from that experience, historically, the trauma that a lot of people experience in the residential school, being taken from their family, being stripped of their language, or being punished to speak their language, and the horrendous abuses that were occurring just because they were Indigenous. Then understanding my role in all of that, and most recently in the public with the 60 Scoop. So I am a 60 Scoop survivor. The government of Saskatchewan created programs called AIM, which is one of the programs, AIM, which is Adopt Indian and Métis Children to non-Indigenous families. And so their intent was to remove Indigenous children from their family. And so there's people in the States. There's a group of us that went to the East Coast, people in Europe. And so right now my frustration and my hurt and my journey is continuing, because I'm trying to track down documentation from the Ministry of Social Services. And so I'm challenging them. Was my adoption legal? It was legal, finalized in Nova Scotia, but currently the government of Saskatchewan is unable to produce any type of reports or documentation that I was legally removed from my family and was legally up for adoption. And so there's many of us out there that continue to heal, but yet that healing can't be done until we get some final finality around this whole process. Yes, Premier Mo apologized. He apologized in the foyer of the legislation building as opposed to in session. I mean, at least Harper did it in session, did the apology in session, so then it's on record, it's written. Whereas when you go into somebody's house, you're not just going to have a conversation in their foyer. And that's where I felt disrespected, of going to the legislation building, and that's where it was. The apology was in there, kind of that foyer. It's not a welcoming, it's not a true apology. And so my journey in that is still growing, it's still continuing. I'm still fighting for that affirmation that what the government of Saskatchewan did was wrong, just on so many levels. But am I going over time? Okay, I'll kind of wrap up. Yeah, and so part of that is, as I continue this journey, exploring and trying to, I'm not here to talk about guilt or to shift the blame. I mean, we all have benefited from the past traumas on both sides. And so there's racism on both sides. But to have that acknowledgement for Indigenous people was wrong. I've lived it, and I continue to live it. I still hold the scars, and I still hold the pain. And so my story is long. This is kind of a quick snapshot of it. But I also want to know, or to let you know, that, yes, I have worked for Regina Youth for Christ, but I actually just resigned today. And so my transition for the next about 5 months I gave them, I'm actually now, God's calling me to be the voice in Indigenous ministry. And so even though YFC had caused challenges for me, but it solidified my faith in Christ so that I can be that voice of, I can be Indigenous and Christian, and we need to be able to build the bridges between Indigenous and non-Indigenous people. And so I'll be stepping into iEmergence, which is just focusing on Indigenous ministry for Indigenous people, but also for non-Indigenous people, because the dialogue has to go both ways. I can't just be the one that's speaking, and so that's where it's really important to build bridges and being able to speak and have my voice heard, but also to continue that dialogue. It doesn't end here, and that hopefully Regina specifically will be that catalyst for change, and I want to be part of that change. So I will end. So thank you for listening.